1960, Fairbanks, Alaska. And this is the meeting of the Committee on the Pioneer Park and Monument in the Fairbanks area. And this is Paul Raymond.
Well, what do you want me to say, Harry, outside of the fact that we're certainly making a desperate effort to get this this land down here next to the Kiwanis Park, which is, I understand, about 73 acres. And if we can acquire this from the federal government and make a Pioneer Park and Recreation Spot, it'll probably be one of the biggest things that the pioneers have done in this area for many years past and many years to come. Well, Paul Griman, president of the Pioneer Igloo Number 4.
Well, I'm Ted Loftus, a member of this famous committee, and we're here thrashing out the ways and means of acquiring this property, and of course, a number of sidelights keep entering into the picture all the time. It's one of the most fascinating things committees I've ever been on because of the tremendous scope of this. But our problem right now is to get the property, and that's what we're working on now.
Well, listen, that was Ted Loftus, the past president of the Pioneers. Don't forget that.
This is Frank P. Young, member of the committee of on the park. And I think at this meeting we have accomplished something towards getting things lined up in shape to present to the proper officials. And what I've seen and heard here at this meeting, I think we're on the right track.
Frank, given the note that you are the past president also.
I am past president of Igloo Number 4, Pioneers, Alaska.
Frank P. Young.
My name is Frank P. Young.
I want to get that on.
This is Colin McDonald, a member of the Park Pioneer Park Committee. And our purpose in this park is also to preserve Alaskan history and to present to future generations a true picture of the early endeavors of its pioneers.
I'm Andy Weekin. I'm here as a neighbor and guest of Harry Hughes.
Thank you. Now you tell about the two Smiths.
Oh, yeah, Louis Johnson, one of our old famous pioneers and a person that's really interested in this also and has a lot of relics to give to this organization and to our new park and recreation and historical site, is absent. Who are the other? Gene Rogge it is. Gene Rogge, one of our recent new members who was equally interested in this project isn't here either. We regret their absence because it's certainly a thrilling thing to be included and to participate in acquiring this land if it's at all possible.
Now, Mayor, this is Harry Hughes,
member of Igloo and 4 and also on the Park and Monument Committee. Place this report we're making up on the tape following this later when it's typewritten and compiled?
Yes, that is right. That's what we want you to do, Harry.
Oh, thank you.
This is Harry Hughes of the Pioneer Park and Monument Committee. I have now completed 3 sets of copies of Pioneer Charter, Igloo 4, Fairbanks, Alaska. Fairbanks Igloo Number 4 banner. Next is a letter addressed to the Department of Interior, Washington, D.C., making a request for this land for this monument. Also, I have a form filled out, form number 4-1267, January 1958, and notarized. And I also have photostat or thermofax copies of the public land order withdrawal number 798
and photostat of the land office records at the Fairbanks Land Office, dated March 19, 1959. Also, I have a plot of southwest quarter of section 9, the piece in question, and also copies of the minutes of Pioneer Igloo 4 on March the 21st, 1960, the committee was appointed. Paul Grimer, president, appointed the following members on the park committee: Frank P. Young, Ted Loftus, Eugene Rogge, Colin McDonald, Louis A. Johnson, and Harry Hughes as chairman. Also on June the 6th, 1960, special committee report. Brother Harry Hughes gave a report on what he is doing on the park committee. At this time, a motion was made by Frank P. Young and seconded by Andy Anderson that we try to acquire certain government lands described herein as the application reads. Lot 12 and southwest quarter section of section 9 in township 1S, range 1 west, Fairbanks Meridian, state of Alaska. Total amount of acreage is 72.64 acres, and the motion was carried. Now I will include the copies of the present typing to our representative Bartlett, Pioneer Senator E.L. Bartlett, Washington, D.C. Dear Brother Bob, for a year or longer we have been concerned about the loss of Alaska, particularly pertaining to the pioneers. We are now trying to obtain a piece of land for permanent use in Fairbanks vicinity where we can establish a free use public park to display and preserve innumerable fast disappearing historical objects of Alaska. This area would include not only historical items but recreation areas, vegetation, and wildlife. Since we wish to keep this place out of local authority, it is our desire to acquire it, if possible, in the government's name, either as a state or government monument. In order to accomplish this, it is our idea that we will have to circumvent the local land office. We understand that there is some thought that this piece of land is to be subdivided and put up for bids by the land office. This hasn't been done yet. With these facts confronting us, we are asking that you, in your capacity as senator, review the enclosed application forms and take such steps as you deem necessary to acquire this land for a monumental purpose in the name of the pioneers of Alaska. And it will be signed by the park committee and the president of the igloo. Dated June the 16th, 1960. Also included are the notes, the minutes of previous meeting, park committee meeting, and maps that were used, tracings of original maps that was used in making this investigation. And I hope this will give you sufficient evidence to work on, Brother Bob Bartlett. This is Harry Hughes, and I'm going to turn these papers all over to President Grimer to get in the mail as soon as possible. Thank you.
I'm R.E. Bob Sheldon, asked to record before the Historical Society at College, Alaska, how I come to Alaska. My father was born in Shenango Forks, New York, in 18 and 29, and as a young man went down the Atlantic coast on a sailing ship to where the Isthmus of Panama is now, and at the age of 19 engaged in employment in surveying the first trail across the Isthmus of Panama, which is about where the canal is now. People were striving to get over to the Pacific side as fast and easy as possible, rather than to go by the covered wagon route. They could get down there by ship, could get across with pack mules on a trail, get out of the Pacific side, come up to San Francisco and be there for this gold stampede that was on in 1849. And my father got to the Pacific side when the job was completed of cutting this trail across and came up to California in 49. He, like some of those who came to Alaska, probably found some gold, but I imagine there was too much gravel mixed with it there too. It's because he didn't do so good as a gold miner. And he finally came on up the coast, the Pacific coast, to where Seattle now is in the early 50s. And when there was nothing but Indian villages such as Mukilteo and Utsalette and Tulalip and I don't know how many more. And he put in some time in that area, what we call the Puget Sound area. In the late 50s, there was a gold stampede developed in what's now known as the Cassiar country on the Canadian side in northern, in British Columbia. And my father went up to Wrangell, which was quite a town in those days, by sailing vessel, and up the Stikine River to this Cassiar gold stampede. As he told me the story, I would say that was the late 50s. And there he met one of Alaska's famous early day pioneers, who became a famous Alaskan afterward, by the name of Jack McQuesten, whom we now know as the man who operated the trading post at Circle City for many years. He and my father became very close friends and partners finally, and started a roadhouse there and operated it for several years. The Canadian government was building roads through the country at that time, and my father, having been engaged in road work and survey work — he was not a surveyor, I don't know for sure just what he did, he might have been the axe man or the cook, I don't know — but he worked for the Canadian government on road work through the middle 60s, and along about 67 or 8, he sold the roadhouse out or turned it over to his partner Jack McQuesten, and he went east to visit his people in New York, which was one of the nicest breaks that I ever had, because while he was visiting his people in New York, he happened to marry a white woman, while all of his cronies over in the Pacific coast married native women, Jack McQuesten included. Jack McQuesten came on into the interior of Alaska. I'm not just sure of the date. The Historical Society should have no difficulty finding that date somewhere recorded. And he operated a trading post at Circle City for many years. He used to write a letter to my — after my father and this Scotch-Canadian Presbyterian girl that he met in New York, that was born in Ontario, Canada — I don't know how she came to be down to New York, but I was always glad she did come down there — they came out to San Francisco And the first child was born in San Francisco in 1871, my oldest sister, who died 6 years ago in New York City. The family moved from San Francisco up to Puget Sound in the early 70s and located at Snohomish, Washington, which is about 35 miles from Seattle by bus now. And there the other 8 children were born, of which I was next to the last. My father used to get a letter from this McQuesten man from the Yukon every year, or sometimes 2 years would pass. And in 1897, he received a letter from Jack McQuesten, which was the turning point in my career, because he said, "Dear Bob, they struck gold near here on the Canadian side, and it looks like it's going to be a big thing. You better come up here and see this country and visit me anyway." To tell an old-time gold stampeder that there's a gold stampede on is all you have to do. It's like when a retired fire horse here's a fire bell, away they go, up and down the pasture, raring to go. And so he was very anxious to go to the Klondike and go to the gold stampede and visit his friend, incidentally. My mother had passed on 2 years before. I was 14 years old, and he was going to leave me with an old uncle there that I didn't like. And I said, "You're not leaving me with anybody. Wherever you go, I go." So I prevailed, and in December 97, we left Snohomish and went down to Seattle. In the latter part of December, and was in Seattle 2 days, waiting for the old steamer Queen to pull out for Skagway. There was supposed to be one automobile in Seattle at that time, incidentally. Some doctor had a horseless carriage there. I heard them talking about it at the in the hotel lobby, but I never did get to see it. It was a sort of a runabout, somebody said, because the doctor would take it out on Sundays when he was not operating, and it would run about a block, and they'd have to shove it back home. But anyway, I never did get to see it, and that had something to do with my later life in Alaska. So we sailed for Skagway, and the boat anchored in the roadstead off where Ketchikan now is, while they put a small boat off and some mail and passengers, men and some Indians, and they pointed out a sultry shack over on the rocks there, and they said, "This is the first town in Alaska, Ketchikan." Well, you can imagine a 14-year-old kid running all over that boat, excited about everything, and when I heard that name, the first town in Alaska, Ketchikan, 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 it stuck in my mind, and I kept harping about it. Ketchikan, Ketchikan. Well, I said, if that's the name of the first town in Alaska, what's the rest of them going to be like? Well, I didn't find out till a good many years later, when I was postmaster at Fairbanks, I found out what was meant by these various names that are so hard to pronounce. We had Christmas dinner on the boat while it was lying there, so that was the 25th of December. We finally got on to Juneau and tied up there for about 18 hours. The first people we met there were the W.W. Casey family, who were operating the Circle City Hotel, who came from our hometown of Snohomish. So we felt right at home at Juneau. We went on then to Skagway. And arrived at Skagway, I would say, as I recall now, the 1st or 2nd of January, because it took about 10 days for a boat to get from Seattle to Skagway in those days, because they had no aids to navigation at all. No buoys, no lighthouses, no help of any kind. They blew their whistle and listened to the echo, and if they bumped into the bank, they backed off and started on again. And if they made it all right, if they didn't, it was too bad. As every old-time Alaskan knows, a good many of them didn't make it. And when you read about the beautiful inland passage today, why, you want to keep in mind that down that inland passage in many places, there's old ships with the fish swimming around through the machinery. However, we was going to start over the White Pass Trail from Skagway toward the gold fields when we were advised not to start so soon because there was such a congestion and the trip was tough. My father was getting along in years. I was full of vim, vigor, and excitement, and I wanted to go. I could put near run over the mountains if they'd leave me go. But we waited, and they started to build a wagon road from Skagway to the summit, known as the Bracket Wagon Road, promoted by a Mr. Bracket and his two sons. Bracket and Sons Toll Road, it was to be. So we took employment on the Bracket Wagon Road. My father was in charge of one of the camps. As a youngster, I was waiting on the table and slinging hash in this mess house. And finally, the road wasn't paying or working out some way. There was so much more work than they figured on, so much blasting to do, that the thing finally died out, and they paid us with checks that were worthless. So they were starting issuing bum checks even in those days. And they're keeping it up, I noticed, by the press. Then they started to build it. Then my father had a heart attack. And his doctor advised him that he better not attempt this trip over this mountainous country. So he had to make the decision to return or start on a very perilous journey. So it was decided he would return to our hometown of Snohomish, and he wanted me to go back with him, naturally. I was going on 15 then, and I was getting pretty important, like all 15-year-olds. I wasn't a delinquent yet, but I was getting pretty important, and when he told me, you come on back with me, and I said, listen, I left that country broke, and I'm not going back the same way. So I had peddled Seattle PIs in Snohomish as a youngster. Seattle PIs were selling for 5 cents a piece in those days, which they still are, I find. And as soon as my father left, in order to support myself, I sent to Seattle and got 25 Seattle PIs on every boat. Cost 2 cents to get them up there. They were a nickel in Seattle. 25 cents was the smallest money they used in Skagway. So you couldn't lose. But by taking these papers to the sporting element, the gamblers and the boys, money don't mean much too, you could get 50 cents. And some of those gamblers said, bring the first paper to us, kid, and we'll pay you well. And we'd go in there, they'd take a dollar off of the bankroll and toss it over to him. You throw him the paper and go on your way. you get rid of those 25 papers in a very short time, because we were at war with Spain trying to save Cuba. And it was known as the War of 1898, Spanish-American War, if you please. We had to save that poor little Cuba. And the scareheads across the Seattle PI were just as big as they are today, 3 inches high, telling about how Ike was treated in Japan. In those days, it was what Admiral Dewey was doing in Manila Bay and what Admiral Schley was doing to somebody. And it was very interesting and exciting, and it was the only communication we had with continental United States was the newspapers that came on the boat when the boat finally got there. So there was no trouble for a boy to make a living in Skagway. Finally, I read in the Seattle PI of how my father died in Snohomish in March of 1899. Somebody saw it in the paper and they said, "Here's somebody with your name died out in the States. Is that in relation to you?" "Oh, yes," I said, "that's my dad." So I had a kind of a bad day for a few days, you know, until I got over that. Here I was really on my own now. No mom and no pop, and really up in Alaska. And when my father died, he left me probably one of the largest estates that any boy was ever left. He left me the entire territory of Alaska in which to try to make a living. And I've been trying to collect on the estate ever since. Sometimes the collecting hasn't been so bad, and sometimes not so good. And so I stayed with Skagway rather than venture into the wild and woolly Klondike. I heard so many wild stories about the Klondike that I decided to stay in Skagway. And as a new youngster around there, I met the Pullen boys, the sons of Mrs. Harriet Pullen, who became one of Alaska's outstanding pioneer women. And those boys, I grew up with them. They took me to their home, and their mother mothered me just like she did her own boys. So I can say to some extent I gathered courage from Mrs. Pullen, because she had courage plus a lot, very large, red-headed woman with four children, three boys and a girl, came up to Skagway from, I think it was Quilisene, Washington, somewhere in that section of Washington, as I recall. And she brought a four-horse team, four horses, and a big mountain wagon. And she hauled freight on this mountain wagon up over this rocky road that was partially constructed. This big mountain wagon piled high with freight, with canvas over it and tied, and this big red-headed woman sitting up on the high seat driving those four horses. Where you look down below into the canyon and see the little silvery stream down there, good many hundred feet below, and the cliff above you, was a position that mighty few men relished. I've known horsemen that just passed it up. They said, "You can have it, or let Mrs. Pullen have it. I don't want it." One misstep, one slip, one rock, one boulder coming down could precipitate you into the valley below and be the end of you. And Mrs. Pullen had that kind of courage, and she, to me, was one of Alaska's very outstanding early day pioneer women. She raised her children, and after the wagon road was out of business and they started to build the White Pass Railroad in 98, she started a boarding house, and she would earn enough money to send her boys out to Seattle to school. Dan Pullen, her oldest boy, became one of the University of Washington's outstanding athletes, as everyone knows that knows anything about the early day history of University of Washington. He not only was an oarsman in the rowing crew, he was football and baseball. And he, in World War I, he was ended up a colonel in the United States Army, and after the war was over, he died in the Walter Reed Hospital with sleeping sickness. That was Mrs. Pullen's first great sorrow. Her second son, Royal Pullen, went to school and became an electrical engineer, and is somewhere in Colorado, the last I heard of him, working for some big electrical company. Her youngest boy, Chester Pullen, was going to out on the boat to Seattle, I would say in about 19 and 6 or 7, and she had given him all the money she had to go out and start in at the Franklin High or wherever he went, and the boat tied up at Ketchikan on the usual tie-up on its way south, and he never arrived at the school. They afterward found his body on the beach at Ketchikan with his pockets turned inside out and wounds on his head, and indicating that he'd been robbed and thrown overboard or something. I consoled Mrs. Pullen by telling her not to hold that against Alaska, because in the opinion of many Alaskans, Ketchikan is not part of Alaska. It's a suburb of Seattle, made up principally in those days of people who had to get out of Seattle for various reasons, and they got to the nearest town they could get to and stay there. The Canadians wouldn't let them go over to their side, so they'd stick at Ketchikan till things cleared up and they could go back, or finally gain enough respectability to go into business and stay with Ketchikan. Having a natural flair for mechanics, I finally got into the steamboat business. As a youngster, I loved boats. I used to see the boats going up and down the Snohomish River. They always intrigued me and fascinated me. And at Skagway, there were many little steamboats, and no gas boats yet had shown up, to say nothing of diesels. So I got to working on the little steamboats and finally got on the run, the mail run between Juneau, Sitka, Douglas, and Skagway, and Haines, and Killisnoo, and Huma Hot Springs, and other waypoints. And for 2 or 3 years, I worked on the steamboats in the winter when it was warm, where you'd be warm down in the engine room. And in the summer, I developed a knack for operating hoisting engines and pile driving engines. And I would drive piles in the summer because it paid a little more and it was more fun. This is R.E. Bob Sheldon again, continuing his remarks on his early life in Alaska for the Alaska Historical Society. I was telling you that I was on this mail run between Juneau and Skagway and Waypoints and incidentally Sitka. And when the great Treadwell mine was running at Douglas, much business going on in Juneau, lumbering, fishing, tourist business and mining. And it was there when the capital was moved from Sitka to Juneau, which I'll not touch on at this time. It's, that's a story by itself, which will be in a separate issue. Finally, in October, in April 1903, Captain Richardson, constructing quartermaster for the United States Army, who afterward became General Wiles P. Richardson, after which the Richardson Highway was named, was authorized to build a post at Haines to be known as Fort William H. Seward. He established his headquarters at Skagway and started employing men to go to this project to build this post. And he was looking for a pile driver crew, and particularly he was interested in getting a pile driver hammer man who runs the machinery that drives the piling. And I was driving piles in Juneau at the time for Ed Webster, who had the pile driving business in Juneau, and a Mr. E.J. Shaw, agent for the Moore Wharf Company at Skagway, who was a great personal friend of Captain Richardson, recommended me to him as a dependable man for that work. And he wired to Juneau and offered me the work and asked if I would come to Skagway and report. Well, it was an advancement and more money, more exciting, something new to do, so I came on up to Skagway. And at that time, 1903, when I came into this big army man's office, swanky office with my cap in my hand, he thought I was some high school kid or something that just ran off from some school and really belonged back in school, I guess, because I looked pretty much like a child to him. I don't know what he had in mind. He says, "You don't mean to tell me you're Mr. Sheldon, the pile driver man that Mr. Shaw recommended to me?" And I said, "Yes, that's right." So he called Mr. Shaw. He called Mr. E.J. Shaw on the phone and had him come over to confirm that. He just couldn't believe that. So anyway, I was employed, and we went to Haines and put in the summer building the dock, the remnants of which is still there. Probably been rebuilt many times, and built that post, which is now known as Fort Chilcoot. And and Captain Richardson spent a good deal of his time there, and he and I became very good friends all through the years. And every time he would come to Fairbanks, he would look me up, and we'd have a little party and celebrate the old days. He was a wonderful person, and this road from here to the coast was named for him. In the fall of that year, I went to Skagway when the work was finished there and went into the power plant as the night engineer in the Northwest Light and Power Company's plant, where I remained 5 years. I've told this part of the story before about the building of what Robert Ripley said was Alaska's first automobile being built in Alaska by a man who'd never seen one, I built the little automobile, which is in the museum here, in 19 and I got it running in 1905 while I was employed in the power plant. I try not to mention too much about the automobile when my wife is present, because she's not the girl that I built the automobile for. She don't like this story. However, it's part of Alaska's history, and the girl that I built the automobile for, that I thought was quite a wonderful institution, she finally married the boy with the horse and buggy that was my competition. So I put the automobile at the museum, and I fled to the interior in 1908 and have made my home here ever since. I came in here in 1908 and took over the power plant at Fairbanks for the Northern Commercial Company, and was the engineer in the operating that plant for 5 years. And in 1913, Fairbanks was going to have the big thrill of seeing its first heavier-than-air machine. A little fellow with a little chin whisker, something like Harry Hughes there, only his was kind of Van Dyke-ish, shipped a little airplane in here that resembled, to some extent, the Wright Brothers Kitty Hawk gimmick. He shipped it in by boat and up by Skagway and into Fairbanks by boat, set it up on what afterward became Weeks Field, which was in the ballpark. And incidentally, I shipped the first Model T Ford touring car into Alaska that same year. And my little automobile arrived here on the 29th of June. The Model T Fords were selling in Detroit at that time for $368 and some odd cents, and in Seattle for $540-something, the difference in the freight from Detroit to Seattle. And when I unloaded mine on the dock in front of the NC Company, where the boats used to land in those days, and paid the freight bill, it was $1,286 and some odd cents. Well, I had one of the best jobs in the country, the engineer in the power plant. He had a steady job the year around, 12 hours a day, Sundays and holidays, and even on your birthday. And I was single, so I was going to have a lot of fun with that automobile. So I took my vacation from July the 1st to July the 15th so as to be in on the big celebration that was going to take place in Fairbanks, the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th. And all the miners and the people out in the outlying districts were anxious to come into Fairbanks to see the airplane. And it was noted in the paper that Bobby Sheldon, the engineer at the power plant, received a new Model T Ford touring car today, and my friends out at Chattanooga and all over the country started calling me up to come out and get them. So while I was on my vacation, I was going to have a lot of fun running my friends into town for the big party. And then, of course, they wanted me to take them back after the show was over, because otherwise they had to hire a team of horses and a buckboard and drive through the Mosquitoes for a couple of days to get in here from Fairbanks Creek and Chattanooga and so on. It was quite an ordeal. The children and the hay in the bottom of the wagon and the mosquitoes fighting the people, and they appreciated coming in by automobile in an hour. So I went out and brought in some people, put them in off at the old Norridale Hotel, which was here where the Log Cabin Chamber of Commerce building is now. And we went in and had a beer. I was getting ready to go right back and get some more people, and they wanted to know how much they owed me. And I said, you don't owe me anything. I'm just having a lot of fun. I'm on my vacation. Oh, no, nothing doing, they said. And all the money we had in those days was gold, $20 gold pieces, $10 gold pieces, $5 gold pieces. In fact, there was no dimes or nickels here in the beginning. I don't remember, 1913, I guess the Signal Corps started scattering pennies around here and nickels and dimes by that time. But in the beginning, 25 cents was the smallest money you used here, too. If you wanted to buy a package of gum, you had to take two packages of gum for a quarter. If you wanted to buy a nickel cigar, you had to take two. You could throw the other one away if you wanted to, but they were two for a quarter. Everything was two for a quarter. However, these people started sticking $20 gold pieces in my blouse here. Oh, no, no, because we want you to take us back. $20 a piece to bring them in from out at the mining district. First thing I know, my pockets were getting full of gold pieces here. And I had to go to the ONC, where I was an employee, and turn the money over to Mr. Preston, the cashier, so I don't be losing it. And they were just forcing it onto you. And after the celebration was over, I was going night and day, hauling people in, taking them back. When they come in, they'd be fine and dandy and sober and industrious and going to see the show. And when they were going back, brother, they were hanging out the side and quite a problem. And at the end of 2 weeks, after going night and day, I ended up with $1,500 that I'd taken in on this automobile. That gave me the impression there was money in the automobile business. That's what fooled me. I quit my job and I said, I must be a sucker working here for a couple of $150 a month and what have you. And you can take money in like that. I'd never had any business experience. I didn't know anything about business, but that kind of started to get me excited. So quit the job, I drove my little automobile down to Valdez to see if we could connect up the interior of Alaska with the coast. Because up to that time, 1913, to get from here to Seattle in the summertime by boat down the Tanana and either up or down the Yukon and out by St. Michael in ocean ship or around by Dawson and Skagway. And if you made perfect connections, you might make the trip in 28 days, but most of the time it took from 30 to 32 days. And about that time, two of my friends here in Fairbanks, Mayo brothers as quick as possible, because something, some malignant condition was developing that their only chance was to get where they had proper medical service. And in those days, Mayo brothers was considered by us Alaskans as the last jumping off place before you went to heaven. If they couldn't save you, you were gone. Seattle had nothing to attract people in those days, but at Mayo Brothers was the big attraction if you needed medical service. So two of my friends got out there just in time to have the doctors tell them, I'm sorry, if you could have got here a little sooner, we might have been able to do something for you. And it was two very sad cases, and it affected me a great deal because I knew these people. So I conceived the idea that if we could get from here to the coast, to Valdez, over the wagon road that they were, this General Richardson was starting to build, if we could get out there in 2 or 3 days, and then catch a boat and get to Seattle in 6 or 7 days, why, you might get to Seattle in 10 days instead of 30 days. Besides, you've got to go on to Mayo Brothers. But it might be the difference between life and death to people who become afflicted with some serious ailment of that kind. So I went into the automobile business. After a few years' experience, I found out that there wasn't as much money in the automobile business as I thought there was. I felt like the fellow said about the kid whose father told him there was money in chickens, and he cut open 8 and never found a dime, and when his father got through working him over, why, he was cured of taking anything for granted after that. So I found out the hard way that the automobile business, while the roads were in the condition they were in those days, was not the big project that I had hoped it would be. So like a lot of people in Alaska who made a failure of business, I finally got into politics. You'll find many cases of that. So I got elected road commissioner in Alaska in 1918 for the 4th Division. In those days we had 4 judicial or political divisions in Alaska, and each one of them had a road set up of their own. And while this great territory had a small amount of money to use for road purposes, in fact I had $50,000 to use for 2 years to build roads in the 4th Division. And when I listen to and read about Senator Greening's request for, what is it, 300 million? How many million is it? I thought, well, we were certainly in the pioneering stage in my day. After two years, I then ran for the legislature. Of that, no, it was 4 years. I ran for the legislature in 1924 and was elected and went into Juneau to serve in the 25th session. And again, I was elected in 26 and served in the 1927 session. I was born in Washington State when it was a territory. And when the boys in the new state legislature, of which I also am a member, were feeling pretty important because they were members of the new state legislature, taking an active part in this new state's future. When it was going from territorial status to statehood, well, I said, this may be a big thrill to you guys, but it's old hat with me. I've been all through it. I was 3 years old when Washington became a state. I have been asked to touch on the subject of Soapy Smith. If I may, if I have unanimous consent to touch on the subject of Soapy Smith, I'll touch on it. It's a story in itself, but I suppose any remarks from anyone from Skagway wouldn't be complete if they didn't touch on the subject of Soapy Smith, because it so happens that I'm, I guess, one of the last few surviving eyewitnesses to the death of Soapy Smith. I was 15 years old when Soapy Smith was shot down at the end of the dock in front of us there, just like a play on the stage. I thought I would never see anything more exciting in my life than a man shot down and the man who shot him down also get shot and the two of them keel over. And the excitement in Skagway was so terrific, with a mob out of control, that my heart went out to Ike Eisenhower when he turned back from the fanatical crowd that was demonstrating in Japan, because in a lesser sense, in a smaller crowd, I witnessed what can happen when a crowd gets out of control. And the crowd was about 50-50 divided as to whether they'd lynch all these birds that were part of the Soapy Smith gang and hang them to the nearest telephone poles, or give them trials and have law and order prevail. I say I thought I would never see anything more exciting in my life. Today, as I sit in my parlor with my little granddaughters playing on the carpet, looking at the TV with their pins in their hands while people are being shot down like this in all directions by the rifleman and everybody else, I think, my God, what's the future generation going to be like? Excitement means nothing to them. They see it every hour of the day that they look at the TV. Soapy Smith bore about the same relation to Skagway in the day that he reigned there as Al Capone did in Chicago at one time. The people who were trying to run Soapy Smith out of the town were the people who were in business and figured if they didn't get rid of this undesirable element, that they were through, their investments were lost because the town depended 100% on transient traffic, trade, traffic, back and forth through there. And it was getting so hazardous to go through the town if you had anything of value that Soapy or his 10 or 15 or 25 goons and gypos that was connected with him wouldn't get it before 24 hours had passed. Soapy Smith and his gang knew all the tricks of the trade up to that time of how to separate the suckers from their money. Many of those tricks have been greatly improved on since those days. Some of them right here in Fairbanks are working pretty smooth. But in those days, it was pioneering in what today we just about take for granted. And so these people who had investments in Skagway and merchandising establishments and so on, the so-called better element, they said, we've got to get rid of this element here or we're through, because people were avoiding Skagway. They were going around by St. Michael and up the Yukon River to get to the Klondike and out that way, and passing up the town. The town was going down like that economically. It was on its way out, and the future was very doubtful if they didn't get rid of these people. So the better element of people, about 12 or 15 of them, held a secret meeting one night in somebody's back room there to try to devise ways and means of ridding the town of this undesirable element headed by Soapy Smith. He heard about it and he went down there and had a gun on him, and he broke up the meeting and he said, you people talk about running me out of here because I run gambling in my place. He said, why don't you run the rest of these people out of here that are running gambling? There's gambling places all over the town. He said, people go into these other gambling establishments and they win a little and lose a little and win and lose, and they become confirmed gamblers. He said, when they come into my place, they don't win. I cure them of the gambling habit. So he couldn't see any sense as to why they'd run him out and leave these other people there, who were really, as he thought, the menace. However, a man came out from the Klondike diggings on the middle of July there, the 4th of July or 5th of July, whatever it was. It's history, I mean, that's recorded. You can read that. And he had a poke of gold. And Soapy Smith had a place, a saloon. And out back of the saloon, through the back door, he had one of these Alaskan bald eagles in a cage out there. And people used to go out and poke their finger at this eagle and make him squawk and open his mouth and throw bread into him and poke sticks at him. And this fellow, Stewart, made the mistake of going into Soapy Smith's place. And he had this buckskin poke of gold, which has been variously estimated to contain anywhere from 7,000 to 17,000. Gold was only worth $20.67 an ounce in those days, although a dollar was worth 100 cents, which changed the values all around. And while gold is worth $35 an ounce today, well, the question is whether the $35 now is half of 35. I wouldn't know. Some of you gold mining people might be able to enlighten us on that. However, he showed this poke of gold and poured some of the gold out in a pan there to everybody to see, because gold was what was bringing people from the States to Alaska. And boy, to see that gold, that made their eyes bug out. And the Soapy Smith gang, goon squads, kept crowding right in on this burden, getting rid of the other people. Sooner or later, they asked him if he'd ever seen the eagle out here. He said no, he'd never seen what eagle. come on out and see him. We got a wonderful eagle out here. So he went out back and to look at the eagle, and when he came to, the eagle was still there. But the boys that took him out was gone, and incidentally, his poker go. Well, that's what precipitated the new development that resulted in the death of Soapy Smith. The business people got together and said, well, this is it. This town has had it. They wasn't using that expression in those days. I don't recall just what it was, but that was the idea. The town was done if they were going to get away with this kind of stuff. Take a man's gold puck away from him right in broad daylight, in the middle of the day, in the middle of the town. So they went down on the long dock. The docks had to be built clear out to get to deep water where the ocean-going vessels could get up to the dock. And there was a long dock and a warehouse down on the Sylvester Dock. Now, there's been many stories written about Soapy Smith and what happened to him. Many of the stories come pretty close. People have written stories that wasn't born at that time, but they had an uncle that talked to somebody that used to know a guy from Alaska that heard something about it. So they read a book about it. And some of the books come pretty close. But I have yet to hear anyone describe what happened to Soapy Smith as from an eyewitness standpoint. And while I'll admit that eyewitness testimony in court is not taken 100% either as against circumstantial evidence, because we all know that 10 people will see an automobile accident out here in the street any place, and in 2 months go into court and tell 10 different stories about what happened. And the same thing could happen in the case of what happened to Soapy Smith. All I'm recording is what I saw at the age of 15, and if somebody else has got some other concept of what happened to Soapy Smith, that's his privilege. I wouldn't argue with him. And what I saw, and when I started out here tonight, I intended to bring my little air rifle to use as a demonstrator as to what happened, but I forgot it when I left home. But this crowd was down in the dock, in the warehouse, where they couldn't be disturbed. They left Mr. Frank Reed, the city engineer that laid out the town of Skagway, who was a very large man and knew Soapy Smith and all of his crowd, and knew them in Colorado before they ever came to Alaska. So he was placed to guard against the approach of any of the Soapy Smith crowd right at the approach to the dock, so that nobody could go down and disturb these men while they were, there was 75 men or more there. I would say at least 75 men involved in this meeting. And they were trying to devise ways and means of just how we're going to do this. Because the United States Marshal and the United States Commissioner and the editor of the newspaper, Dr. Hornsby, were all on the Soapy Smith side. They either was afraid to take any action against him, or for reasons of their own, you couldn't get any help or satisfaction from either the United States Deputy Marshal or the United States Commissioner and the editor of the paper, Dr. Hornsby, would put an article in the paper that didn't hurt Soapy Smith any. So that was the situation in Skagway, and they had quite a problem to decide. Were they going to organize into a vigilantes committee and come out with guns and run everybody out of Skagway that looked like a Soapy Smith sympathizer? Or what? And while this discussion was going on, Soapy Smith threw his Winchester rifle over his shoulder, heard about this meeting, and started down to break up the meeting again like he had done previously with a smaller meeting. When he got to where Frank Reed was, Frank Reed was sitting on the railing of the dock. He was sitting on the railing of the dock. I'm not going to sit on this table. I'm going to just give you an idea how this big man was sitting on the railing like this. You held that side. And he was like this. He didn't have any gun or anything. And Soapy Smith wasn't much bigger than I am. He was an inch taller than I was. He wouldn't weigh any more than I was. He was 38 years old. He had a heavy, full black beard, a very dark brown beard. And he was a good-looking man and a very clever person, very nice person. He'd have gotten by in any legitimate activity, giving value received, but he just preferred to play it this way, get something for nothing and give nothing. As I say, he knew every trick of the trade up to those days. Several preachers were soliciting funds in Skagway at the time, for instance, to start building churches, just like they are in Fairbanks today. And when a preacher would come along and want to ask for a collection, or a donation, contribution, Soapy would say, "Sure, you bet your life, we're from our churches. Dig up $100 and throw it right in there." And the preacher would be very gracious and appreciative and go on his way. Soapy would say to one of his trusted lieutenants, "You follow that guy, and when you think he's got enough to make it worthwhile, why, bring it back." And that's what went on in Skagway all the time. Some people have tried to make out that Soapy Smith was a sort of a Robin Hood that robbed the rich and gave it to the poor. And nothing from my standpoint. And I knew him, and I sold papers to him, Seattle PIs, for 50 cents on a dollar. He was liberal. From my standpoint, he was far from being a Robin Hood. He not only robbed the rich, but he would take it from anybody that he could get his hands on. And so he came down to where this guard was stationed, this big man who was sitting there just waiting for Soapy Smith or any of his crowd to try to come down there. But he had nothing, no arms in sight. Soapy Smith had this Winchester. Everybody that came to Alaska in the early days, as every old-timer knows, thought he had to have a Winchester. I don't know why. They never had any more use for a Winchester than they'd have for a toy hobby horse. But everybody had to have a Winchester. Seattle sold everybody a Winchester. Most of them ended up as part of heating boilers in the interior if they ever got in that far. So Soapy came down like this, stepping it right off, and of course, all the news kids and all the people who were not taking an active part in this discussion down in the warehouse, they followed along behind because Soapy had a gun. They knew about what had happened a few days before. There was going to be some excitement. So we all followed along behind to be sure and not miss anything. When Soapy got, it's now 9:45 in Fairbanks, and this thing happened on the 8th of July in Skagway, and while the daylight in Skagway is different than it is in Fairbanks, I would say, as I recall, that the visibility at the time this thing happened in the evening of July the 8th was just about like it is here right now at 9:45 in Fairbanks on the 23rd of June. You can see 100 yards or 150 yards every move anybody makes. It was just twilight enough that when anybody shot a gun, you could see the red flash. When a gun is fired in the daytime, you don't see any red flash. But when it gets a little more twilight, and of course dark, you can see the red flash. Well, we could see the red flashes when the gun started to go off. We couldn't hear what these men were saying, but we could tell the way they were jerking their heads, and Soapy Smith was a pretty cocky guy. He had a gun beside. He was jerking his head around there, and while we couldn't hear what they said, after the shooting was over and both men were down, and I'll explain as I saw it,